welcome to Conductor's Brew, everybody. Matt, good to see you, my friend.
Good morning, Larry.
And
good to have you back in the yard.
It is a lovely morning here in the front yard. Yeah. Though the front yard has seen its share of trouble. For those of you not living in the greater Salt Lake, northern Utah area, we had a monster windstorm come through on Tuesday. And as we say in North Carolina, the front yard's been mommicked.
Mommicked?
Mommicked, yes.
I've never heard that.
Well, you haven't spent enough time in North Carolina.
Explain that. Where does mommick come from?
Mommicked basically, I don't know where it comes from exactly, but it basically means messed up, disrespected.
Mommicked.
Basically, you've been beat up, disrespected, and now you're tired.
How do you spell that?
How you spell it?
Yeah.
Oh, gosh. M-O-M-M-I-C-K.
Okay.
ED, mom, I think it's mom, CK.
I'm gonna look it up.
You check
at some
that
point.
Out.
Urban Dictionary, maybe we'll have it.
Yeah. I mean, I grew up with that word. It's it basically it's like after that long day at work when you've just been disrespected, put through the ringer, and you've been mommicked.
I see. Yeah. Well, the yard does sort of feel that way.
Yeah.
Gosh, you know, 6 a.m. Tuesday morning, the wind picked up. It had been breezy all night, but then at about 6 a.m., right in the money, we started measuring wind gusts up to 80, 90 miles an hour.
Yeah.
It was an unofficial gust at the University of Utah up the hill at 112 miles an hour.
Wow, that's well into the hurricane range.
That's ridiculous.
That really is. And we were talking about this before we came on the show, is that, you know, when I was looking at the sustained winds, I'm like, yeah, this looks like about a tropical storm level force wind, which, you know, on the coast would take down some trees, but it wouldn't be a catastrophe.
Mm-hmm.
But when I went out and walked around, there were just so many trees down. And I thought, it occurred to me, well, you know, these trees aren't the kinds of trees that deal with this. And therefore, you know, those species wouldn't have been on the coast.
Would you say that there's a particular breed of tree that seemed to fare worse in this?
Yeah, well, the pines.
Yeah,
and you
I
have
agree.
This pine here that's, that's leaning currently
I wish
over
you all
the
could
street.
See this. It's the pine. It's a large pine. It's got to be, what, 50, 60 feet? It's huge. It was leaning before the storm. But now it's leaning a little bit more, and it's pulled up a bit of its roots along with it, and there's a little bit of a cavity underneath it you can see in the yard, and it's a little dangerous here, and it lost another big limb on I think the maple tree here. The house is intact. So
yeah, that's
good.
True.
Not everybody can say that.
No, there is a house in the neighborhood that came right down the porch, and you could see into the house from through
oh,
the roof.
Gosh.
It was really terrible. And so a lot of cars got damaged. So, yeah, I fared fine. Looks like you guys did, too. So
we had, here at the house here, I only lost power for a couple hours Tuesday.
Yeah.
But a lot of colleagues just a few blocks away even didn't have power again until Thursday. So 48 to 72 hours later.
Yeah.
And some people still don't have power.
Right. I think
right now.
I think Rocky Mountain Power, so they were going to...
A week later.
Going to get everything hopefully done by today. But... Yeah, it was a bit of a it kind of made me a little homesick in a weird way, because I'm like, oh, this is like a hurricane, and I don't really long for hurricanes, just to be clear about that. But
it was not a
it reminded me of hurricanes.
Well,
it
they
really
called
did.
Them they called them downslope winds, where we had this big low pressure area just to the south that was pushing in wind from the east down the canyons. And I think that's what the canyons create this funnel effect. Like, we have these events, I don't want to say frequently, but once or twice a year, where the mouth of one of the canyons or multiple canyons, they'll have some really impressive wind gusts, but it's not usually this widespread. I think Rocky Mountain Power is saying, like, this only happens once every 40 years, every four decades.
Wow.
Yeah, and everybody I've talked to in town who's lived here their whole lives, or at least 20 years or so, says they say they've never seen anything like it.
Yeah.
And that actually... is a bit of a foreshadow of my rant
okay.
today.
Okay, we'll put a pin in this until it's time for the
rant. I guess
rant.
We should properly introduce our show, because we haven't even talked about coffee yet.
That's true. Let's get that going.
But before we get to that, I did want to mention what today's show is about. We are going to be discussing a bit of the COVID-19 studies. There's some studies that have been coming out in the last couple of weeks that are interesting updates to what has come out earlier. So I wanted to just recap a little bit of those studies and what the latest research seems to say. There's good news and bad news, I'll say that. But first,
yes.
Let's what, are
do
you,
this.
What are you drinking there?
I don't know.
Larry?
You tell me what I'm drinking here.
So
I just poured in my mug.
This is a new foray for me into the world of coffee-ing. I have roasted my first batch, my first real batch. This is very exciting for me. My brother was very kind and bought me for my birthday back in August a little hand roaster, which is just this ceramic or clay or something, a little roaster. It's got a little hole in it, and it looks like an overgrown, an oversized golf driver. And basically, except it's all circular, and it's got this little handle coming off of it, and it's hollow, and you stick the green coffee beans in it, and you throw it on your oven or your stove, and you roast them up, and you let them sit for a few days to outgas, is what it's called, I guess. So, so this is a Colombian from Beans and Brews here in town. Beans and Brews sells green coffee beans, unroasted coffee beans.
I wasn't aware
of that. I wasn't either.
For the home roaster.
I think so.
Yeah,
and I think there's others. It was retail. Yeah, and there must be others that do the same thing. There must be a market, a niche market for that.
Yeah.
So this has been home roasted by yours truly. I did a few batches. I wanted to get a couple different kinds of roasts. So there's a lighter roast, a really light roast, mixed in with kind of a medium light and a medium dark.
Yeah.
For balance, really. And I had this... I first tried this out of the siphon. I made siphon coffee yesterday, that vacuum immersion thing, and it's totally tastes totally different than what this tastes like. This is French press that we're drinking right now. The French press is like a really, it tastes what? Like a really great kind of well-rounded, roasty, very roasty flavor, I would say. Like a nice roasted, kind of almost smoky. That's a product of the roasting process because there's no ventilation really. It's just, you know, most famous fancy roasters, they have like, you know, really this big industrial sized roaster that's very, very precise, and you can create these specific roast profiles where the temperature comes up at a certain rate and then sits at a certain place for a while the beans roast, and then you can do different things, you can program it into the thing. This is just by hand. This is basically like roasting coffee over an open flame, more or less. But I don't know. Where was I going with that? This is I don't remember.
Well, I'm not sure where you're going with it, but you were talking about the smoky flavor of it, and I can tell that.
Yeah.
And I mean, I really like it. I mean, it's not overpowering or anything like that. It's got a lot of nuance going on there.
Thank you. That's where So this French roast, right? It's got some nuance, but it's like at its core, it's like it tastes like a Colombian coffee. It's kind of nutty and not really that fruity, although there's some of that. But when I made the siphon coffee, it tasted totally different. It tasted like vegetable tea or something. It almost tasted like lentil soup. It was really vegetal. It was very, very interesting. It doesn't taste anything like what it tastes like right now.
Huh.
Yeah, it almost tasted like a green plant, really. Yeah, instead of coffee. So, yeah. I'm going to have
really
to try
good.
That at some point.
So
you
might be discovering this podcast is kind of an excuse for me to come over and drink really good coffee.
Yeah.
So it's
which I don't mind at all.
The podcast keeps Matt motivated to offer even more tasty coffee for me to drink. And we'll talk about some music, but really the purpose is I'm here for the coffee.
Yeah, that's what it's for.
And it's really quite good. So I'll look forward to your future concoctions as we go along.
Well, me too, yeah.
Well, shall we nerd it out? Would you like to go first?
Yeah, let's nerd it out, even though I've already nerded it out in multiple ways, meteorologically and imbibally.
This is what people come for, man.
This is
par for the course.
This is why I listen to the show. So what's on your mind, nerd moment wise, Larry?
Oh, you want me to go first?
Sure. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Well, I've been talking my mouth off.
Fair enough. All right, my turn.
I'm going to pour some more coffee here while you're talking.
Please, thank you. So as we're getting into the pandemic, I was thinking about, and it was kind of inspired by what Salt Lake Symphony is doing, and they're doing a piece just for their winds, right? They're separating their string. They did a string piece, and they're doing a wind piece.
And
that's what McKeever's conducting.
Yeah.
And so I was thinking, what are the really great kind of, you know, non-like pieces that you could take your wind section out of and put your brass, take your winds and brass out of? And I was reminded of a beautiful piece that I encountered in a video game years ago for the first time.
A video game?
Yeah, video game. I'll get to that in just a second.
Wait, is it written for video game?
No.
Okay, it was used in video game.
Let me explain.
I'm sorry. I'll stop. I'll just shut up. I'll let you go. It's your nerd moment.
Fair enough. So the piece I'm referring to is John Adams' Grand Pianola Music. Mm. And it was written in 1982, or written in 1981, premiered in 1982. But it's written for basically a standard orchestral woodwind section. double winds, flute, oboe, clarinet, bassoon, and a basically a standard brass section with, I think it requires three percussion players. It's got like vibes, marimba, glockenspiel, all that kind of stuff. As well as three female voices, I think two sopranos and an alto, and then two keyboards. And the keyboards are the kind of the primary part of this. So, I mean, it's you'd have to obviously bring in some more forces if you're just using your standard orchestra. But and it's also kind of a challenging piece with this minimalist music. It's kind of an endurance thing to do. We were talking about this before we started recording.
It's all the same. Well, it sounds very, very similar.
Well, it's all these repeated patterns, yeah. And they repeat, and it's 30 minutes long. So you need an orchestra and some piano players with some good chops.
Would you like some more coffee, Larry?
Please, thank
you
very much.
Look at that color. It's like almost a maroon. Yeah. Oh yeah,
oh, it's great.
All right,
thank you, sir.
You're welcome.
So it's not for everybody, and I've never done it before, so I can't really speak exactly to the difficulty of it. But I've studied the score, but anyway, it's just a gorgeous piece. And when I listen to this piece of music, I see cities in my mind, and this happens a lot with minimalistic music. It's something about the minimalist style and the modern architecture, the minimalist style of modern architecture. And the way he takes these wide spaced intervals, it kind of creates the sense of height and grandeur.
When you say wide spaced intervals, you mean like just the voicing of the chords, the harmonies? Okay.
Yeah, kind of the repeat going back and forth, and it feels like there's this. I'm thinking of this particular spot where the sopranos are singing these intervals, and they're just leaping up between these wide spaced intervals, and it's kind of what Aaron Copland does in his sort of his Western pieces that give the sense of bigness and space,
only better.
Yeah, I know you and Copland. I know we know this.
I didn't say anything.
We know this from 2 weeks ago. Yeah. Anyway, that's okay. But it's the sense of height and grandeur that to me, and plus the minimalist and the repeated patterns, it just gives me the sense of being in this big cityscape, and you're like flying around between these buildings and it's just gorgeous music. And I was listening to it last night, looking out over the city, because I have a nice view of downtown. And it just really speaks to me. And I believe, I believe I'll read this to you. So the premiere went pretty well, but when he performed it in New York, it got booed.
Really?
It got booed. Yeah. This is according to the Wikipedia page.
Okay.
And it's quoted and cited, so we'll assume it's true.
When was the New York premiere? Was it in 82?
It was in 82 also, in the summer, according to what I found here. Huh. But anyway, he says, true, this is, John Adams, quote of John Adams, says, true, it was a shaky, very shaky performance, and the piece came at the end of a long concert of new works, principally by serialist composers from the Columbia Princeton School. In the context of this otherwise rather sober repertoire, grand pianola music must doubtless have seemed like a smirking truant with a dirty face in need of a severe spanking.
Excellent description.
I just love that. Excellent. And that idea, because it's a very bold piece of music. And with minimalism, it's very tonal. And I think it has this, I think maybe sometimes people might look down at it because of that. I don't know. I don't want to get into the whole debates of isms with new music. But it does celebrate the sort of the bold textures that you can get with all these instruments, and I just love that kind of simple boldness.
I love the sound. There's something about his music in particular. I've listened to Philip Glass, I've listened to Terry Riley and Steve Reich, or is it Reich? I don't know.
Yeah.
One of those. How do you pronounce Steve Reich?
I'm not sure.
I've heard different things. Anyway, all these composers you can hear in John Adams' music, but Adams does something different in a way. It feels different to me.
Yeah.
I fell in love with his music when I first heard Harmonium, which is this big work for chorus and orchestra, massive. But that's really just the tip of the iceberg when it comes to his music. And I was lucky to see him rehearse and perform with the Atlanta Symphony doing Pines of Rome, as well as his new concerto for violin called Shahrazad. And it was incredible. And it sounded just unlike anything I've ever heard, especially the violin concerto. His music sounds like anything unlike anything I've ever heard. And there's something about it that I agree. It takes me to a different place in kind of how my perception feels. Mm-hmm. And actually, the first piece that I ever heard of his was Short Ride in a Fast Machine. Mm-hmm. I was a student at UConn in the University of Connecticut. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I guess that's the famous one because a lot of bands, the wind bands, do it.
Yes.
And
yeah, we
that wind band arrangement is excellent, mm-hmm. and it's hard, but it is. I still remember the first impression I got was, I feel like I'm floating over the ground at high speed.
Yeah.
It has this sense of motion that is irrepressible.
Yeah.
And yeah, it reminds me of The Matrix also.
Well, yeah, it's that technological patterns. Yeah. It's about patterns. It's about simplicity. But at the same time, like, it's not simple. It's simple, but it's not simple. That sounds so dumb to say it that way. But the changes are, you, in other words, you can perceive these changes over time.
No, you're
time.
Right. It is simple, but not simple.
Yeah.
I mean, we were talking also, you know, have we performed any of this music? And Larry, I don't remember if you said you'd actually perform some of his music.
I played.
You played Short Ride. Okay.
But I have not conducted.
You can attest to its difficulty
in
the moment, because there's so many little variations on a theme, if you will.
Yeah.
And really, they're just motives, little cells, little rhythmic or melodic cells that are repeated. And if you're not paying attention, if you're not really reading the music, you're going to mess it up. Because mm-hmm. there's these tiny little differences. I've conducted... what was the name of it? I just had it at the tip of my tongue. The Chairman Dances.
Right.
The Chairman Dances. Saying. Yeah, which is an excerpt from Nixon in China, I believe. It's from his major opera, Nixon in China. Mm-hmm. Pardon me. And it's mesmerizing music, but it's very difficult to conduct. I would say almost impossible to conduct because of the constant attention. If you really want to be involved in conducting it properly, you have to go bar by bar, almost literally, to find the tiniest little differences, mm-hmm. and to really embody those physically is a very difficult thing, I think. But anyway, wonderful music.
Yeah. And the thing is, what I love so much about all kinds of music, not just Adam's music, but I love to be able to perceive the structure. I love to be able mm-hmm. to sort of take it in and understand how it's going over time, and whether that's, you know, a sonata form, or if it's something like this where it unfolds so gradually over time. I feel about music the way I feel about architecture. Huh. I like to be able to sort of take in a whole building, but then zone in, focus in, and see details. And, you know, and that's why I love all kinds of architecture. Like, I love all kinds of music.
It's just different forms.
Oh, I'm a huge architect nerd.
That.
I'll have an architect nerd moment. I don't know a lot about it.
So,
I have no training. But
there must be buildings then in the Avenues neighborhood here that you have...
Oh, I know.
Yeah. Well, what are some of your favorite buildings in the area then?
Oh, well, my favorite building in the whole city is City Hall.
Really?
Yeah. It's a Romanesque.
The one revival. Right across the street from the county building.
Right. It's called City County, but
it
serves
across
City
the street
Hall.
From the main library.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
And that's my second favorite building is the main library. You couldn't get two more different buildings.
No.
And they're right on next to each other on the block.
Softy was the architect for that.
I don't know.
Moshe Softy, I think. S A F D E.
No, I don't know, but you know, the Romanesque style was a 19th century thing. It's kind of like a revival thing. Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
And
I don't know much about it.
And it's completely different than the modern style of the main library. But I love the fact that they're on adjacent blocks, and it's my favorite two blocks in the whole city.
Oh no way!
Yeah, and I'm jealous of you that you get to work at the main library.
I work part time at the city library there,
and
it's a wonderful place, a wonderful building. Unfortunately, we're not open to the public at the moment.
Yeah.
Although that will be changing on the 21st of September.
That's true. Yeah,
in a minimal way. Yeah. But yeah.
So anyway, architecture and music. I mean, they're very similar. And
tell me more about that. Tell me more about your fascination with architecture and how that relates to form and music.
Well, I don't necessarily think of. I guess I should say what I like is I like perceiving form, as I was saying earlier. And I can appreciate structure, and I can appreciate how things are put together. And what I'm able to do, I'm able to kind of step back and see how a whole thing is put together. Mm. I sometimes have trouble with details. Like, if I'm in the grocery store and I'm trying to find something on a shelf, I sometimes have trouble finding it. So,
well, that's a man thing, isn't it? Isn't there like
this...
You know,
I'm not sure if that is or not.
I think genetically, I've looked into this because there's this refrigerator blindness phenomenon. Have you heard about this?
No.
So... I don't remember where I heard this. It's been years since I've read this, but apparently, I'm going to have to double check this to make sure it's actually factual. So, disclaimer, this might not be true. but I can attest to this anecdotally. If there's something in the fridge that I am looking for specifically, and it's not my refrigerator.
Yeah.
And somebody, okay, let's say I'm a guest at your house, and you tell me, oh yeah, go into the fridge, grab the Frank's hot sauce for me off of the shelf.
Sure.
Plugging Frank's today, I guess. And I say, okay, and I go look for it, and I can't find it. Like, where is it? I can't see it. Apparently, if that's the case, that's a byproduct of our evolutionary adaptation to hunting. And so hunter-gatherer societies, there was a certain group, I think traditionally, traditionally, I don't know if this is the case for everybody, the women and the children would be the gatherers. And so their eyes developed evolutionarily to better identify like small things like berries on bushes and things that weren't moving.
Okay.
And then the men who were hunting would have more acute distance vision and be able to pick out small things that were moving subtly amongst
the leaves.
So taking
in a whole vista,
yes,
but find the small.
Interesting. So apparently this explains why men cannot find anything in the fridge, and if their wives come to go look at it, they're like, oh, it's right there. What are you talking about?
If it's moving in the fridge.
If it's moving in the fridge, yeah. If there's a black widow or a snake in the fridge, you can spot. Or if there's beer, then it's easy to find.
That's right. Beer is the exception. Well, that could be true. I have no idea. I've actually never heard that that theory. But my mom has the same issue or the same type of way of perceiving, so it doesn't hold true for her. She's
okay.
She's also can see the big picture, but sometimes
yeah, that was
trouble.
A tangent. Go back to the music.
Yes. Yeah. But anyway, so yeah, the idea that that you have this whole structure, and I like to perceive how the whole thing is put together, and then I can zone it and see the details, but okay. I just love perceiving structure, and it's like I said, it's not like I like one type of architecture or other, just like I don't like one type of music.
What is it about the structure? Is it just aesthetically pleasing? To just take it all in and look at it and view it?
You know, it's something about seeing the patterns and seeing the concept of the architect.
Just I agree that that's fascinating.
Music is a music. I mean, so is literature. It's obviously, sculpture and painting, they're all the same thing. It's just a different medium. It's all about these structures that are created, or the intentional breaking down of structure. As a compositional choice as well too, and you can see it like with the main light. Well, it's not a breakdown of structure, but you know how the main library kind of tapers down and kind of disappears into the earth.
Yeah,
you know, it's sort of a structure is altering over time.
I like
and
that kind very of organic in a way, sort of connecting the earth to the building.
Anyway,
well, it's too bad we don't have a neuroscientist here. Where's Ashkan when you need him?
He's a neuroscientist?
Well, he's got a background in neuroscience.
I didn't know.
He's got an engineering degree.
Oh, that's right. We did talk about that.
I think in his engineering.
Oh, my goodness.
But anyway, he would have a lot to say about this, I think. No, I had something that came to mind there. There must be some sort of things, you know, something happening in our brain also that draws us, that makes us drawn to certain structures.
Yeah.
So when we talk about architecture, for instance, that's you know, a visual thing. But it must activate something in the brain that is deeper than that, right? There must be something really satisfying about being able to visually identify interrelationships and connections and patterns in buildings, much in the same way that our ears identify those things in music. Mm-hmm. However, let's take it to the next level then. So something like grand pianola music, if we were to look at the score to that, you know, not listening to it, but just looking at the score visually, that's one thing, right? Mm-hmm. You know, we're looking at the piece, we're saying, oh, this is what's happening, I can see it happening notationally. How do we identify those patterns visually versus hearing them and identifying them upon listening to the piece?
Well, I think one of the issues with minimalism is that because it unfolds so gradually over time, it's hard, unless you had all the pages out and could kind of scan the whole score, like you had a giant corkboard, and you could put all the pages up there, and you could have bionic vision. You could like zoom in, but you know, just a couple of pages, you know, the amount of change is not great.
Okay,
you know, whereas this, you know,
it's like slow motion.
Like in common practice period, the sentence structure, you know, it's just a few measures. You can
say
see
a
that.
Thing, you say it again, you elaborate on it, and you conclude it. Right, that's the sentence structure. It's basic, right?
Pretty much.
I'm trying to avoid, verbose music lingo. Yes. Say things.
I'm just
again.
Impressed I remembered sentence structure.
Yeah, that's good. That's good. And you can have nested sentence structures within periodic structures.
Yes.
So what's the form, if I can put you on the spot? What's the form in grand pianola music?
You know, I don't know.
Yeah, I don't either.
I mean, broadly speaking, it's in three parts.
Okay.
I'm looking at my notes here.
Yeah.
Part 1A is fast tempo. Part 1B is slow. And then the third section, which is called On the Dominant Divide, is fast. So it's a fast, slow, fast.
Dominant divide.
Yeah, which is...
Interesting. Yeah, like you know, for the record, you don't have to tell us that you're reading off notes. Nobody can see that. So if we
I like to full disclosure yeah. that I don't have
no,
all
we
this
just
in
think
my
your
brain.
If it's just off the cuff like that. No, right. I want to suggest that.
I also want people
that,
to know I prepare for the show.
Yes, that's right. Well, yeah. You know. No, I think that's a... I'm going to give myself that as a listening assignment this week, is to listen to some of that.
Yeah.
And that brings to mind another piece by John Luther Adams. No
yes.
relation to John Adams.
Right.
John Luther Adams.
Or the president.
Yeah, or the president. That's right. Who wrote a piece called Become Ocean
mm-hmm.
a few years back. I think it was premiered by the Seattle Symphony, if memory serves, that is a slow motion depiction of ocean waves crashing into the shore.
Mm.
It is fascinating.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I recommend that. If you don't know that piece, check it out. Check that out. Check out grand pianola music.
Yeah. John Luther Adams is... I'm not as familiar with his stuff, but I know a lot of people whose opinion I respect sing his praises. So good.
Yeah.
Well, that was a very long nerd moment for me. So thank you for indulging.
Oh,
it.
My pleasure.
And I didn't mention where I first encountered it. So there's a video game called Civilization 4, and I've been a fan of the Civilization franchise of strategy games since Civ 2. Dates me a little bit there. And then Civ 4, for the background music while you're playing the game, they use clips of quote-unquote real
Calypso.
Music, like, you know, the music
clips.
That existed.
Not Calypso.
Clips of.
Clips of.
I don't think they have any Calypso in there. That would be cool.
Clips of Calypso?
No Calypso. But they have, they use piece letters like Beethoven in, like, the different eras that your civilization goes through. When you get to sort of the, you know, the classical period era, you hear Beethoven, you hear, you know, classical composers. So they're using pre-existing music as opposed to music written for the game.
Okay.
And then when you get to the modern era, grand pianola music, or a portion of it, is at least... is one of those pieces in the soundtrack. So I was sitting there playing this game, and like whenever it'd come on, I'd be like, my ears would perk. I'm like, man, this is a really great piece of music. And I go back to playing my game, and like it happened over, and I was like, finally, I've got to figure out what this is. So I went and I searched, like, what is the soundtrack for Civ 4? And I just started going through all of them until I found it.
Oh, cool.
That's how I found
it. You found it.
Yeah.
It's amazing how new that music sounds. And it's almost half a century old now.
Yeah, we really, should we call stuff from 82 new music? But
no.
Yeah.
No, I don't think so. Well, I still think of, you know, the early 20th century. It's 21st century, excuse me. I was right. I still think of early 20th century music, like Rite of Spring, for instance. I still think of that as, quote-unquote, new music.
Yeah.
But it's not.
It's 100 years old.
It's over 100 years old, yes.
Yes. Well, anyway, it's been around, but it's a classic in my heart.
Well, I have a nerd moment also.
Go for it.
But it's much less involved. It's, for once.
Yeah. No, for
I was thinking about...
Because you got me off on architecture. You got me going on architecture.
No, I figured
that's,
I would explore that a bit because I think there's a lot of interesting parallels there. And I wonder. This is the question I had when we were discussing this. Is I wonder at what point is the brain no longer capable of discerning patterns in art? And what I mean by that is, over time, there's got to be a limitation. For listening to a long symphony, for instance, like a Mahler symphony, a first movement of a Mahler symphony is frequently in some sort of sonata form. So A, B, A. You know, there's an exposition, development, recapitulation. That's a really broad brush, but let's just grant that for now. If it's half an hour long, there's 10 minutes of the exposition, 10 minutes of the development, 10 minutes of recapitulation, maybe plus some coda, maybe, right? Is the brain really going to be able to identify the recapitulation after it being spaced out for 10 minutes from the development? I am not sure. Certainly in like a Mozart symphony or Haydn symphony where there's just 30 seconds or a minute separating the exposition from the recapitulation, you know, the development is so minuscule.
Yeah.
Maybe the brain must be able to connect those two things. But for instance, something like in architecture or in larger forms of music, like grand pianola music, it takes real concentration and study, I would say, to be able to say, oh, this part is like that part, if they're separated by a certain amount of time, or if they're separated by small variations, like in minimalism, where there's not really a development, it's always developing. It's right. developing slowly. So anyway, that was a question I had. Was what limitations exist on our perception that make form indiscernible?
You know, I have to feel someone's done a study on that, and I would love to see that, because you're absolutely right. There are pieces where we take these, you know, in Haydn's hands, the form is happens in a shorter period of time, and then
especially the dance forms, like the trios, and sure. minuet trios, yeah,
and then they get stretched out by, you know, Beethoven, and then kept getting stretched by other composers. And what point? Yes, more coffee. At what yep. point do you lose it? And I don't know the answer to that. Obviously, it's going to vary between people, you know. Mm-hmm. But
yeah, that's true.
And then at what level are you perceiving the form? Like, do you just? I mean, that's the exact return of the same theme. I can hear that. Mm-hmm. Or is the form more obscure and it's just sort of a key relationship, and you might not get it on the full level
that connection.
Yeah. But at some point, at some level, your brain gets a sense of a symmetrical structure there, even if you can't precisely identify that it's happening and say, okay, that's where it's happening.
Yeah.
So I don't know. That's a good question.
I think
and we should ask. Yeah. We should ask Ashcon.
My real nerd moment of the day had to do with acoustics, out of doors acoustics, actually, because I was thinking about
how appropriate.
I was thinking not only about the windstorm we had and how strange that sounds to hear winds of that speed, that magnitude for such a time.
Yeah.
But also,
it's a bit frightening.
It is a bit frightening. Very. It was stressful, to say the least. I was thinking back to the rehearsal we visited last week. And the different sounds that are created outside in different circumstances based on the shape of the ground, even, and the materials on the ground, and how when an orchestra, for instance, rehearses out in an open field, how much of that sound is lost to the sky, the open air.
Mm-hmm.
And we're so used to hearing sounds indoors. Let me say it this way. We're used to hearing indoor sounds indoors. We're not used to hearing indoor sounds outdoors. So hearing an orchestra rehearse outside is a weird sound. Mm. It sounds like a totally different thing in a way. Not unpleasant. The rehearsal that we went to, the Salt Lake Symphony rehearsal, they were in under a gazebo that was made of wood, and it was such a shape that it served to funnel the sound, I think, into the center of the gazebo, and it actually sounded quite pleasant. I thought it was a really beautifully balanced, warm, rich, quite present, well, not loud, but present sound mm-hmm. that was really conducive to good music making, I would say. You know, we're picky about that. Artists are picky about that. We want to perform in halls that make us sound better, because some halls do and some halls don't. They make us sound worse.
Right.
And so I was just thinking about outdoor venues. This strikes me as a great time to experiment more with different outdoor venues.
But, have you done much outdoor?
No, I haven't done any.
Really? Okay. Yeah. Well, I have, having done several myself, I can absolutely attest to the difference, both as a conductor and as a player, and as a trombone player sitting in the back. When you are outdoors, you're not getting at least the venues I played, you're not getting as much feedback from the rest of the ensemble, so you really kind of feel a little nervous.
Yeah.
You feel a little isolated. Speaking of, if you go back and listen to the podcast that we did with Dr. Baldwin last week, and you hear the portion of us talking here in the front yard versus when we cut to the interview we did under the gazebo, you can hear the difference in sound. You can hear a bit of the echoiness, the fact that we were under the gazebo, as opposed to where we are right now, which is under the fresh air, and there's not the echoey, not the echoey nature to it. So it absolutely does make a difference being outside. It is quite different, and you know, a lot of people are going to get those experiences. I've played at the Taylorsville Day Festival several times, and that's of course an outdoor venue, and I've conducted there, and you lose some of what you're hearing. So it can be a little bit disconcerting the first time. We'll just put it that way.
Yeah, it is. You feel like you're off in no man's land.
Yeah, like I say, especially if you're sitting in the back. You can't, and you can't hear the bouncing around. So, yeah.
Well, I'm sure
it's a reality we're all going to have to deal with.
Players in front of you don't mind, I don't think.
Yeah.
They're like, oh, Thankfully, I can't hear the trombones. I can still hear them. No, that's wrong. You're always going to hear the trombones.
Yeah.
But that actually is a great segue into a bit of the COVID studies that I wanted to talk
this,
about.
This is the main thing.
Yeah.
And you are sort of acting as host and guest.
I'm going to interview myself.
I'll interject some too. But
good.
you've done a lot of study.
I'd like this to be a discussion, a conversation. Yeah. I've spent a lot of time and ink and paper, scrap paper, leafing through the studies on COVID. All the way back through May, April and May, when these first started. And there were some earlier ones, too, in March even. But a lot of those have been updated. I think they've all been updated, really. So I wanted to touch on a few of the commonalities and the differences in these studies that just kind of illustrate that a lot of what we're seeing from the academics, the scientists who are studying the spread of COVID and who are examining the possible methods of routes of contagion, so-called super spreader events,
vectors of transmission.
Yes, exactly. Thank you. Vectors. Ooh, that's a good word. Mm-hmm. The science really agrees on quite a few things, and there's only a couple things really that are still that we're still uncertain about, that there's a bit of debate about, which is fascinating. The World Health Organization, the CDC, according to some of the studies that I've read, have been slow to accept aerosol transmission as a significant vector, and when really there's no grounds to minimize that whatsoever. In fact, it seems that the CDC's and World Health Organization's reticence to accept aerosol transmission as a major contributing factor is rooted in its history of really focusing on droplet and touching transmission.
And I remember that in the early days, that's what everybody was talking
about. That's what everybody was talking about, yes.
But, you know, just, I don't know, common sense would indicate that the aerosols have to be something seriously considered.
Yeah.
And we should do a caveat that we are obviously not medical professionals here. We're not those kind of doctors. but we have to study this stuff or be aware of this stuff as part of our job. And we're doing our best to kind of just wade through this at times contradictory information. Sorry, I just wanted to throw that out there.
A lot of it is somewhat contradictory, but not really. So just to give us the short version, to summarize, aerosol transmission is an issue. It's happening. Mm-hmm. There's really no question of that. There is even, let me back up a little bit. Things like the flu, for instance, which we haven't always been told is transmissible by aerosols. We always hear, wash your hands, don't touch surfaces, you know, don't be around somebody who's sneezing or coughing, because that's what really produces the droplets, the larger droplets. We're told to avoid that, but we're really not told, you know, avoid crowded spaces, at least as far as I know, at least as far as I've heard, which is part of the reason schools they become such hot spots during flu season, is because they're the worst environments to be in, really. Is they're crowded, they don't always have great ventilation, you know, kids, even if they're washing their hands, they're speaking, they're screaming sometimes, and there's aerosol transmission of the flu virus that can happen. Now,
so there are studies that indicate that.
Yes, okay. The flu is transmitted via aerosol, as are other transmissible diseases. It's not always the most contributing factor. In fact, I think one of the things that divides a highly contagious virus or disease from a non-highly contagious virus or disease is its transmissibility via the aerosol route.
And so we should probably take a step back and sort of discern what the difference between the droplets and aerosols are. I think at this point, unfortunately, most Americans probably know what that is. But as I understand, and correct me if I'm wrong, aerosols are the smaller particles that tend to float in the air.
Yes, for an extended period of time.
From simply breathing and talking.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one of the reasons why singing has been a concern with this music industry, particularly because when you're singing, you're pushing those aerosols out. And they can hang in the air and build up, which is why outside has been talked about being better. Which is why we're doing this podcast outside is because it's going to float away. Yeah. You know, it's not going to build up in a small confined space of a room. Whereas the droplets are something that's, you know, when you see those slow motion pictures of people sneezing, that's the the nasty looking spray that comes out of somebody's nose.
You can't see the aerosols. You have to use other tools.
Which is what these studies in University of Colorado Boulder is studying specifically, like which I'm assuming you're going to get to.
Or fog or something, yes. So these droplets, the droplets that we sneeze or cough out, they fall to the ground eventually because of gravity. They have enough mass.
Right.
The aerosols, however, tend to congregate right in front of the body. Although we think of, if we're indoors, for instance, and we don't feel the air moving, we think, this air is getting stale, it's just going to stay where it is. No, in fact, the air is moving very, very slowly to a certain extent. And so a lot of these aerosols then will kind of sit in front of you or go around the back of your head, around your neck. Sometimes they float upwards slightly, but it seems that they more or less stay confined within a 1 to 3 meter space around the body.
Meter, not feet.
Yes, correct.
Meters.
So let's say
for
three,
our American
3 to 9 feet or so. Yeah,
big difference.
3 to 10 feet or so.
Yeah.
Yes. So and that actually. So the studies that I'm reading, let me start with singing then, because it seemed that singing was one of the things that freaked people out really quite a bit earlier.
If I can interject, on there is that rehearsal that took place in Washington State.
Oh, yeah.
That was a super spreader event.
And they did a study on it. Two people actually died from that event
as a result of that event. Yeah, at least. And they were, at the time they were keeping their hands clean, but it wasn't that. It was the aerosols.
They were not social distancing, and they did not put any limits on the rehearsal duration.
So they were inside.
They were inside.
Yeah, they were doing at the time, I think, they're trying to do the best, but that's just evidence that in absence of information, we need to be very, very careful.
That's when we were assuming that aerosols were not really a significant factor in transmitting the disease. When they had chairs, if you have chairs between 6 and 10 inches from each other and you're in the same space for 2 hours, that becomes an extremely high risk environment. An example of an extremely low risk or no risk environment is simply not gathering at all.
Yeah, you by yourself.
Yes,
in a
even
room.
Being outside, separated by 6 feet at least, even wearing masks, there is still a nominal amount of risk there.
Right.
There still is. Okay, so let me go back to July 13th. This is the University of Colorado at Boulder and University of Maryland study that was put together by the National Federation of State High School Associations. Mm-hmm. They first looked at winds and brass because they were really concerned about the marching band season.
I should give a plug to CODA, the College Orchestra Directors Association, is also a co-sponsor of that. So
great.
CODA's on the board with that one.
So this study back in July initially confirmed the effectiveness of social distancing. To keep at least 2 meters or 6 feet apart, that seemed to be the boundary, the reasonable boundary, based on all the science that had been done, the studies that had been done of this aerosol transmission. 6 feet was the boundary around which an infected person is highly risky. So if you're within that 6 foot region around a person, your risk of contracting COVID, especially if there's speaking or singing going on, goes up greatly. In addition, it seems that the duration of time spent in that within that circle increases the risk as well. And that just is simply because of the greater concentration of infected particles.
I think I've heard people refer to it as the virus load.
Yes.
Like how much of it you're coming into contact with.
It seems that 30 minutes, an exposure duration greater than 30 minutes is correlated. Correlated, not causing, but correlated with a much greater risk of infection. And that by no means means that you can, spend 30 seconds with somebody and be safe. It's just saying that after the 30 minutes, that the risk goes up greatly. Okay, so they also, that same international coalition, came out with a second round of studies in August 6th, that re-emphasized the importance of wearing masks properly. So a poor-fitting mask, I think most of us, unfortunately, wear masks in a poor-fitting way. I am guilty of this as well, I have to say. And it's made me reconsider which masks I'm wearing and how I'm wearing them. There should be no gaps. The nose has to be covered. It shouldn't be looser on the edges. Yes, you see a lot of that, especially in grocery stores. It drives me crazy. A well-fitting mask will not have any gaps. The nose will be covered. It will be tight around the edges. And this study even suggests that the mask should be tight enough to leave an outline on the face once it's removed.
Oh my.
So, performing arts activities, to sum up the conclusions of the study, performing arts activities have found that engaging in the performing arts creates an aerosol that is less than coughing, but more than talking. So singing, playing an instrument, is more risky than talking, but less risky than being around somebody who is actually coughing with the virus. So it's interesting that we have to get into the nitty-gritty of this in a way, because the coronavirus has been measured at 0.1 microns in size, all right? But the median particle size for singing is 1.3 microns. And for clarinet playing is 0.9 microns. So plenty of space for coronavirus to attach to. The same study also went and looked at how particles are transmitted via aerosols around certain instruments.
So kind of back up for a second.
Sure.
So you're saying that, and I may have missed something.
Yeah.
So the singing produces larger aerosol particles.
Yes. So the median size is 1.3 microns.
Versus speaking. Larger than...
I don't think I mentioned that. It's something about the... I think it's more about the volume or the space around which you are dispersing the particles. So talking, for instance, I think because... Okay, so what it is, I remember, is talking is assumed to be at a certain volume.
Okay.
Singing is usually assumed to be at a larger volume. Yeah, in terms of loudness.
Sure.
So, therefore, that's correlated with more dispersion, a greater dispersion.
So it's not the size of the aerosol particles, it's the area
Correct.
That they inhabit. Okay,
yeah.
Okay, I got you.
I think all that the size was saying here was that the coronavirus, the virus itself is small enough to attach to the smallest aerosol particles that we project while engaging in these activities.
I'm clear now. All right, thank you.
Sure, yeah. So they saw that particle emissions were comparable between all wind instruments, interestingly. Between all wind instruments and singing and acting, except for the oboe.
Ah.
Yeah, and I've also seen different recommendations for trombone playing. That trombone playing, for some reason, has a greater area of dispersion. So the authors of the study recommended that because they measured more particle emissions near the bells of instruments, that bell covers should be used with multi-layered filtering materials. And they also recommended a time limit of 30 minutes maximum. Time of at least 1 minute for an air change before the next rehearsal period or the next gathering.
So 30
of folks.
Minutes maximum. What was that? 30 minutes maximum
of rehearsal
with wind instruments.
I think with anybody.
Oh, evens
in any circumstance. If there's in a circumstance where there's a six foot distance guidance is followed. Which applies both indoors and outdoors, by the way. But a 9x6 distance box for the trombones. That even in those, and even in that circumstance, the rehearsal period should not exceed 30 minutes. Okay, so that was back in July, early July. Now I want to skip to a study that it's a British study that the Brass Bands England came out with August 4th. That was seeking to supplement the research on whether or not aerosols were a significant source of transmission. They concluded that while playing a brass instrument, again, brass bands, they were mostly interested in the brass instruments, that while playing a brass instrument, the propagation of respiratory aerosols does occur, and to a smaller extent, so do droplet-sized particles, but at a lower level than when the subject was breathing without an instrument.
Hmm.
So interestingly, playing a brass instrument does create a problem with aerosols. It does not create a problem with droplets.
catches inside of the instrument,
yes.
maybe.
Now, yes.
What that spit valve's all about.
Okay. So that brings up the whole the whole next issue, which is what do you do with the condensation in the spit that happens when you play an instrument? Not just brass, but winds, of course, too. Mm-hmm. You have to dispose of that properly. So it was also shown that using a barrier cap on the bell, they called it a barrier cap, which was like a bell covering, some sort of cloth covering, offers a significant reduction in the production of respiratory aerosols into the immediate surroundings, which can offer, as they concluded, a possible mitigation method for playing in groups from the release of aerosol-type particles, especially in hard-to-ventilate places. So the takeaway there is, if you're going to play instruments, find a way to cover the instruments, even if it does impact the sound in a way, and it will. But there's materials out there that I'm sure we can use to block the aerosols, but that do not create a significant barrier to the sound. So that was from August. Now I want to skip to a set of an FAQ, frequently asked questions, developed by Professor Jose Jimenez from the University of Colorado Boulder. This is the same author, same professor, who is renowned internationally, actually, for his studies, not just this study, but for also notably leading the University of Colorado Boulder study, back in May or June, I think. This was updated yesterday being September 12th. In terms of general importance, this author writes that the CDC states that ballistic droplets are the dominant form of transmission. And fomites...
These are the heavier...
Yes, the heavier, the larger particles, the ones that you sneeze or cough out mostly. Mm-hmm. Fomites, which are... The fomite is a technical... F-O-M-I-T-E. That's the technical term for transmission by touch. So if touching a door handle or a piano that somebody else just touched or something, that the fomite transmission is minor, but possible, and that aerosols are minor. The CDC is still saying that aerosols are minor, as does the World Health Organization. And now then, the same author goes on to say that many scientists disagree, including the authors of this set of frequently asked questions, that the aerosol pathway is at least as important as the other two, the droplets or the fomites. And some think that the aerosol pathway is the dominant form of transmission, with some minor contribution from touch and a minor contribution from ballistic droplets, almost only for coughing and sneezing. And so this is based on the review of the available evidence, which they do summarize. In particular for this virus, they say there is a lot of transmission by people without or very few symptoms, so-called asymptomatic transmission. Those people do not or rarely cough, so the usual ballistic droplet pathway is very diminished.
Interesting. That's
people are also hyper aware of the cough, so it makes sense that that wouldn't be a huge contributor, because if you're around somebody who's coughing, your first instinct is to what? Like, go away.
Sure.
So it doesn't... This is not me speaking. This is the authors of this set of questions speaking. It does not seem credible that the pandemic spread is dominated by people coughing and scoring quote-unquote direct hits on other people's eyes or nostrils or mouth.
Many people don't know how they were infected, and it is unlikely that they wouldn't remember a direct hit by a cough. This author says the reasons for the resistance of the CDC and the WHO to aerosol transmission and their adherence to ballistic droplet transmission despite lack of evidence are rooted in history. And that gets into another can of worms, which I won't get into at the moment. I think it's enough to say that there's disagreement still, as of today, about, you know, among the world's leading health organizations about how much aerosols actually are an avenue of transmission. So here's a great question that I want to read the question and the answer in its entirety, because I think it's really important to distinguish
this disease from other diseases, but also to show really what's happening with the aerosol transmission. So here's the question. But if COVID-19 was transmitted through aerosols, wouldn't it be highly transmissible like measles and have a very high R0 and long-range transmission? Here's the answer. In a word, no. This is a myth. Here, some people are confusing an artifact of history with a law of nature. There is no reason that nature can only produce highly transmissible aerosol-transmitted diseases. It was the entrenched resistance against aerosol transmission initiated in 1910 by Chapin's book on the sources and modes of infection that led to only highly transmissible viral diseases being accepted as being transmitted through aerosols, because only for those the evidence was too obvious to be denied. Plus tuberculosis, which is less transmissible due to some amazing experiments. Other diseases such as the flu, the SARS virus, or the MERS virus also have an aerosol transmission component, but the lack of acceptance of that fact has deprived the medical community of accepted examples of less transmissible aerosol diseases.
Interesting.
Yes. Also note that the RT for SARS-CoV-2, the COVID virus, is very high for super-spreading events, which can only be explained by aerosols. This is easily explained by aerosol transmission, depending on whether infected people participate in situations conducive to super-spreading, and with variable emission of viable viruses in time and among people. This leads to a very skewed distribution of the R number, with many low values and some very high values. So here's another example. So that's the answer there. And he goes on to explain that measles and tuberculosis were thought to spread by the droplet or fomite route for decades, when really they can also be spread by aerosols.
Bottom line is that it seems like there's a decent chance that aerosols are a significant thing, so we need to just act as if it is.
Yes.
You know, I mean, it's too deadly of a thing to not assume that aerosols are a problem. We need to wear masks and we need to do all that aerosol mitigation.
Yes. There's a widely held misconception that the virus is naked in the air, which is not the case. It attaches to these very small droplets, and the aerosols, which are defined as the size of an individual virus particle is very small, 120 nanometers or 0.12 microns. So the respiratory droplets or aerosols are larger, but still small enough to remain suspended in the air for long periods of time. So the bottom line is the virus is small enough to attach to droplets. We know how big the virus is. We know how big these droplets and aerosols are. And we know that the virus can attach to the aerosols and the droplets and remain suspended in the air for up to hours at a time. So this seems pretty cut and dry to me at this point.
Well, it's at least clear enough that, like I said, we need to treat this aerosol thing seriously.
Yeah. Yeah,
and excuse me, as I'm sitting here coughing.
Well, we're outside. No,
and I'm not coughing in your direction. No. Covering my cough, it's certainly frightening enough that we have to err on the side of caution.
Correct. Really, it's a high risk activity. Anytime we gather in public, when we're breathing.
Yes,
basically,
which
yeah,
is most
yeah.
of the time.
So this has made me think about the plans that I've initiated for some of my groups. I work with one group in Wyoming, as you know, Larry. Mm-hmm. And we are planning to have 45-minute rehearsals maximum, social distance, in certain rooms that are large rooms but not outside. So dispersion is, I would say, minimal in that case. And there's no mask requirement in place in that part of Wyoming, if there isn't any part of Wyoming, I'm not sure. And that makes me concerned, because while the infection rates and the rates of transmission in that part of the country have been very, very low, thankfully, there is still the risk of spreading this thing around. Yeah. Even if, especially if one person has it and they don't know they have it, it's not enough, it seems, to ask people to stay home when they're sick, because of the possibility of asymptomatic transmission via these aerosols.
Yeah.
The good news is, so that's the bad news. The good news is, if I can sum up, that if you're far enough away from other people, at least 6 feet, 9 feet seems to be a better number. If there's a 9 foot distance between you and the next person, the likelihood of you breathing in or spreading your aerosols to another person is low within about a 30 minute time frame. If there's very little airflow happening, it seems. So that's good news, I say good news, because if we're gathering, and it seems like we're going to be doing so, if we're gathering and we're in a room together for 30 minutes to 45 minutes at a time, even if somebody is ill and has something that they're spreading, if we stay far enough apart, while it's not a low risk environment, it is lower risk than being, much lower risk than being in a regular choir or orchestra setup where you're mere inches from each other
right.
for 2 hours at a time.
Right. That we this, yeah. you know, that just can't happen. Right. I think having the social distance, having the masks, everybody in masks, and having a big room, like we've gone to rehearsing in the gym with one of my groups just because of the size of the room, so we can spread out and we leave the space, let the air exchange and all that kind of stuff.
So it seems like most universities at least are following these guidelines. I mean, there's so many questions in terms of liability and also what really is the appropriate thing to do. And so universities right now, it seems, are rehearsing outside, which they can do for now.
In some
parts of the country. which is probably the safest way to get together right now. But still wearing a mask, a properly fitting mask, and still distanced socially, 6 to 10 feet at least.
Yeah.
So that's really the gist of what I wanted to get across today. Talking about the virus itself is different, though, than talking about its impacts on the arts. And
yeah.
I have here a study from the Brookings Institute that was published last month in August, called Measuring COVID-19's Devastating Impact on America's Creative Economy.
Okay.
This is not good news, unfortunately.
No.
It is not. And we can focus on this in another shows, but I just wanted to highlight a few statistics, which is that this study has estimated the loss of 2.7 million jobs. And $150 billion in sales of goods and services.
In the United States, or is this worldwide?
This is just the United States. Yeah, this is just ridiculous. So, those of us who have been tracking this from the very beginning, we, I think, have an understanding that it's never going to be the same, really. At least in the near term.
Yeah.
It's going to take years, and it seems a viable, effective vaccine for us to even consider going back to the quote-unquote normal setup where we're all kind of crowded around.
Yeah, where we have packed concert halls.
It's just not a responsible thing at the moment. So a lot of people are suffering because of this, not just because of the illness itself, but because of its impact on the arts.
Yeah. It's rough.
It is rough.
Well, Matt, thank you so much for taking us through a walk through the studies. Would you mind? I mean, you said all the names of the studies. Would you mind just sort of recapping the major ones that you looked at, so if people want to Google those studies and read for themselves?
So there's the National Federation of State High School Associations,
and that's the Colorado.
That's University the UC Colorado Boulder and University of Maryland study. It came out in two parts. There's the Hochschule für Musik in Freiburg, a German study. That came out July 17th.
And could you spell that for me?
Sure. If you go to their site, HOCHSCHULE, Fur, F-U-R, Musik, M-U-S-I-K, Freiburg, F-R-E-I-B-U-R-G. Okay. And they've had several updates. They've been on this thing since the beginning, since January, actually.
Yeah.
Not January, but I think March. And they've come out with several iterations, all concluding that droplets and aerosols are the main avenue of transmission for this virus.
And there's a band one.
Yes,
from
then there's the British Brass Bands from August 4th that concluded the same thing. There is, I didn't mention this, but there's a Time magazine article from August 25th titled COVID-19 is transmitted through aerosols. We have enough evidence. Now is the time to act. Also by Jose Luis Jimenez, who is a professor of chemistry and a fellow of the Cooperative Institute for Research in Environmental Sciences at the University of Colorado Boulder. He was one of the lead authors on this University of Boulder, Colorado Boulder, and University of Maryland study that I just mentioned. Then there's a University of Minnesota study that came out September 7th. I didn't mention this one either, but I'll briefly kind of recap from their abstract that they went and found that aerosol concentrations exhibit two orders of magnitude, as they said it. That really the spread of these aerosols depends a lot on how people are playing their instruments, including their dynamic level, how loud they're playing, the kind of articulation they're using, and the normal respiratory behavior of the individuals playing the instruments, and even using certain techniques. So their findings brought some insight to risk assessment for winds and brass, including orchestras, community worship bands, and churches. A lot of churches use big, large bands for worship music classes, etc. And then there's the latest continually updated University of Colorado Boulder FAQ that is very, very helpful. That is from the 13th of September today.
And as I mentioned, that's the one the code is involved with, and there's a lot of organizations involved with that one. That's the one I'm kind of keeping my eye on the most, for sure. All right, well, thank you so much, Matt.
More info as it comes.
Yeah.
Yes.
I think we'll have to keep revisiting, but I think that was a good kind of walkthrough of where we are and what we know right now.
It seems like we know a lot. And that, unfortunately, a lot of the leading health agencies in the world are a little bit slow to acknowledge and provide guidance based on the latest research.
Yeah.
So, better safe than sorry. Err on the side of caution.
Exactly. We all have to kind of operate from that perspective. All right, well, you know what that means, Matt? It is time for the rant. Go for it, my friend.
I know what it means. Oh, I love this part. So my rant this week is simply how terrifying the wind sounds at 80 miles an hour. I don't think I've ever experienced that. So going back to the windstorm, right?
Yes.
Yes.
We'll bookend it with
Can I just rant about this terrible windstorm that we had? I mean, there's just destruction everywhere. It's ridiculous. But the sound of the wind when it's consistently blowing at 40 to 50 miles an hour and then gusting to 80 to 90 miles an hour is just an unreal sound. This roaring... People who have lived through tornadoes and hurricanes have described it as this freight train sound.
Yeah.
And now I think I get that. I think I understand. There's this really... It's not even a distant sound. It's more of a general white noise that is really deep, a deep body to it. And I never want to experience that again. 2.5 hours of that was quite a lot on the nerves.
You been through a hurricane?
No, never.
Never been through a hurricane?
No, I grew up in Connecticut.
But not in Georgia. I guess it's far from the coast.
We didn't really get much wind. You know, when I was in Valdosta, a couple hours from the coast, a couple hours drive from the coast, I lived through a couple of tropical storms that dumped some rain on us, but we avoided the worst of the winds. I'd seen some gusts, but nothing, you know, thunderstorms. I'm familiar with severe thunderstorms for sure, but I've never experienced a storm that just was nonstop for 2.5 hours without any rain or lightning. It was just wind. It was surreal. Can I just say how scary the wind sounds at that point in time? So that's my rant, is no thank you. I don't want to deal with that ever again.
Well, yeah, and I, growing up on the coast, I have been through, I can't remember my first hurricane because I was a baby.
Yeah.
You've
been inured to it.
Well, that's what I was getting ready to say. It's like, yeah. I don't think you ever do.
Oh, wow.
I've been through more than I can count, hurricanes and tropical storms and some very bad ones. And there's a point where, like, I don't want to say you get excited when there's a hurricane. Some people do. But there is an energy level with a hurricane, and you have all this hurricane prep. And then you're like, oh, we're going to be inside, and you have this sort of like not bunker mentality, but like a hunkering down. And like I said, I don't want to say that it's enjoyable.
Yeah.
It's not, but there is a certain energy level, and it's not particularly scary, but you're excited.
Yeah.
Then there reaches some sort of point, and it's got a lot to do with the wind level, where, at least for me, it goes from being just excited and like kind of just keep being alert for everything to being really terrified.
Yeah.
And it's I don't know how to describe it, if it's a speed of the winds or whatnot, but I know that feeling of being really, really frightened by it.
Nerve-wracking.
Yeah, and the duration of it. And how long it just goes on and on. And I remember one hurricane, I was in college and I was in my apartment. I lived on the second floor. This is in North Carolina, in Greenville, North Carolina. And we had a hurricane come through. Maybe it was Bertha, I don't remember, but I could hear the roof creaking.
Ooh.
As the wind was pushing on me, you could hear the sounds of the boards moving. And I just remember thinking, like, I could be looking up any moment and see this roof lift off.
Yeah.
And so it is quite terrifying, and so I know what you mean. And it's funny how like I said, it's at least for me, it shifts pretty quickly. Like, you kind of feel okay. Like, yeah, we're prepared.
Yeah.
We're hunkering down. You're kind of alert, and you kind of got an energy with that. And then that energy turns to fear once it gets a little bit too intense. And then, of course, one of the hurricanes I went through, which was Floyd back in 1999, where we had terrible flooding, which was an event that took place over long weeks, because the water levels kept rising as the rain came down. So there's all kinds of ways to have trouble with hurricanes. Which leads me to my rant, if I can go. My rant is this stuff that's happening, and I'm, again, not that kind of doctor, but all evidence is pointing that we're getting worse and worse hurricane seasons. We have these terrible fires out west. We have got to do something about what's going on with climate. And I think right now they're looking at potentially 5 hurricanes in the Atlantic.
Yeah.
And we are getting into, I mean, this is peak season. September is, we're right at the peak. So it's not unusual to see more storms, but they're more frequent, and they seem to be becoming more powerful, or at least we're getting more frequent powerful storms. And of course, these wildfires, things are getting, the wet places are getting wetter, the dry places are getting drier, and we're seeing the effects of it. This is not just sort of this could happen. This is happening. It's happening right now. And people's lives and livelihoods are really in danger. And, I'm just one voice, but just adding my voice that we need to do something about climate. It's we're past time at this point.
Yeah. I mean, any way we look at this, we're here. We have the ability to curb emissions. We have the ability to be greener in the way we live.
Yeah.
Why not? Why not try to take better care of the place we live? Why not try to be better stewards of our home?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's the only plan we've got.
Yeah.
So, well, this has been kind of a serious,
yes,
a bit of a downer
got
podcast.
A little dark. Well, let's
but
end
we
on
got
a high
this
note.
Tough times.
It
tough
is.
Times we're in.
I want to plug a couple of events because I think this is a good way to end the show today.
All right.
We mentioned when we found out where the Salt Lake Symphony concert was going to be happening, we'd let you know.
Okay.
And just yesterday, I saw a Facebook post from Dr. Robert Baldwin, who's been a frequent and wonderful guest with us, that the Salt Lake Symphony will be having their first concert since, what, March?
Yeah.
Even earlier.
I'm not sure. I mean, my last concert was the very beginning of March. Okay. So I imagine, I think theirs was either end of February.
Earlier. Yeah, they might have had to cancel right before the March concert. But anyway, there. Right. We mentioned when that concert was happening, but we didn't know where. So now we have an update on where. September 19th, 2020, 6 p.m. It's an all Dvorak concert, and it's happening at the gazebo at Holiday City Hall Park. That's the gazebo at Holiday City Hall Park. 4580 South, 2300 East.
Excellent.
And that's next Saturday. Well, that's Saturday. That's Saturday the 19th. Mm-hmm. They're going to be doing Dvorak's Serenade for Strings, as well as his Serenade for Winds, Cello, and Bass.
Excellent.
Well, there's no admission charge, but online donations are appreciated. There's one other event I wanted to plug in. That is the Utah Philharmonic's concert, first concert, which is the University of Utah's premier ensemble, happening Thursday the 17th.
Okay.
Outside in President's Circle on campus at the U, under the tent.
Under the tent.
And that's also free, I believe. Yeah.
Well, I'm glad the tent's
general
okay
admission. Yeah.
After the windstorm.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Anyway,
yeah, they took it down.
Yeah. Anyway.
Yeah. Yeah. But it's. But anyway,
it's, people are making music again. Yeah.
It's heartening to hear that there's going to be some performances. I hope we can keep it up. We're just going to play it by ear, as it were, and just keep going. So anyway.
Yeah.
Thanks to everybody for tuning in. We appreciate you listening, and we'll be back next week.
Yes, we will.